Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank of katelovingshank.com and the author of Prayer Prescriptions for Nurse Healers in the upcoming Prayer Prescription Trilogy. Joining me this evening is Gary Kowalski, author of his recently published book, Blessings of the Animals, Celebrating Our Kinship with All Creation. Gary was on my radio show before, and we talked about his then newly published book, Goodbye Friend, Healing Wisdom for Anyone Who Has Lost a Pet. His other books include The Souls of Animals, The Bible According to Noah, Theology as if Animals Mattered, Science and the Search for God, Revolutionary Spirits, The Enlightened Faith of America's Founding Fathers, and Earth Day, an alphabet book. Please go to www.kowalskibooks.com to contact Gary and purchase his books there and also on Amazon and all, you know, Barnes & Nobles and all those places. The call-in number this evening is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Gary Kowalski. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Kate. Good to be with you again.
Thank you. I'm so happy to have you.
Yeah.
And, of course, you're being a Unitarian minister. I was raised a Unitarian, so I can totally relate to more than you can realize.
These days, people of practically every faith are getting into the act with animal blessings. I mean, these go way, way back. You know, if you look at Christian tradition, there's something called Rogation Days that goes back to the 5th century, probably, when the priests and parishioners would go out and walk around the fields and expect the borders and boundaries and check on all the birds and orchards and beasts of the field. But it's hundreds of years old, the association of looking to our animal companions and to the wild creatures to ask for their blessing and to acknowledge our kinship with them and all the ways that they enrich our lives and make the world whole. You know, as I was writing this book, I heard a story from an acquaintance of mine. She's has a Hispanic background, and she told me a story that she heard from her her grandfather, her abuelo in Spanish, and he heard it from his own padre. It was a story about how in the distant past, dogs went to church on a regular basis. apparently, the dogs were in the custom of going to the sanctuario, and the men would remove their sombreros and hang their hats in the cloakroom, and the dogs would also remove their tails and hang them in the coat room when they went into worship. And then one day a fire broke out in the chapel, and the men all raced out and grabbed their hats as they exited, and the dogs did the same. But in their great rush, some of the dogs grabbed the wrong waggers. And according to her grandfather, this is why dogs have the habit of sniffing each other's butts still to this day, because they're looking for their own proper tails. So,
this
is a kind of a lighthearted book. I've been doing animal blessing services for years. There are always children present and, animals round out the family. We've not only dogs and cats, but parrots and tortoises and jars full of earthworms and, of course, you know, ferrets and hedgehogs and varieties of rodents and so forth. So it's always a high point of the year. People enjoy it. I point out in my book that the word blessing is related to the word English word bliss, and both of them share a cognate with our English word blithe, which you know means cheerful, exuberant, upbeat, happy. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think animals share with us. They just have this natural joy. They really need so little. They're content simply to be, and they have a lot to teach us there.
Yeah, there's nothing like being in the presence of your animals, and I like to call it the free zone, where you just suddenly don't want to do anything but just hang out with them. It's very, very soothing.
It is. They don't have any heavy agendas. You know, I point out that you know, none of them's worried about their stock portfolio. None of them's running for Congress. none of them carries around travel documents or passports or the kind of papers they want in a state like Arizona or Texas now, because they live in a state of bliss where they don't care about such things.
They have so much to learn from that. It's just remarkable.
Yeah.
But I want to hear a little bit about Smokey, your newest...
Well, you know, I called my first dog Chinook my spiritual guide in my first book, The Souls of Animals. You know, I said he's like a Zen master. He eats when he's hungry. He sleeps when he's tired. He's not all hung up about sex. He doesn't hold a grudge. Really, a very enlightened being and an old soul. If Chinook was my spiritual guide, Smokey was his dark shadow. he was my nemesis. We took Smokey in when he was a puppy. His mother had been abandoned and taken in when she was pregnant and had 10 pups. So, you know, shortly after we said goodbye to Chinook, we went to look at these puppies. And, of course, then you're hooked. And
yeah.
my wife's theory was that out of the 10, you get the biggest dog because he won't have any self-esteem problems. So turned out that she was absolutely right about that. You know, Smokey was of the opinion that he was the alpha male in our family, and it took us several years to work that out, several years and a lot of biscuits, but finally we came up with a more or less cooperative arrangement. So yeah, the book is dedicated to Smokey.
Smokey.
He finally settled down, and I did bring him to one of the animal blessing celebrations. So he was a good friend. You did say
that you said in the book that you hadn't brought Smokey yet. So you have, and how did he behave?
Oh, about like you'd expect. He was the life of the party. Of course, I was conducting the service, so my wife had to keep an eye on him. No, by that time he was about 10 years old, so he'd started to turn into, I can't say a gentleman, but he'd started to settle down somewhat.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
well, he was
a rescue dog, so people used to ask what he was. We'd say, you know, he's part shepherd, part kangaroo, and part snapping turtle.
Yeah, our dog Ulysses passed in January, and we got Pearl, and she is a wild dog in Tennessee, totally wild, and she's still very wild in the sense that she just goes out and starts eating insects, of course not this time of year, but and she just has this wild look about her as soon as she gets outside. It's really kind of cool.
Yes, I have a ministerial colleague who named his dog Kali, after the Hindu goddess of destruction. You're mentioning the wildness brought that to mind. Yes, the animals have a way of introducing a certain amount of disorder into our lives. But Smokey, you know, is not the only critter that I brought to church. We used to have chickens. I'm a vegan now, but for years I was a vegetarian, and we wanted to have the chickens out back so that I knew where the eggs came from, so that I could be sure the hens were happy and the eggs were truly free range and so forth. But I brought a chicken to church on Easter Sunday. You know, we had an early family service with the children there, and I'll tell you, in showbiz, there's an old saying: never follow a dog act, but if you're a minister, never try to compete with a chicken either. You know, the probably most of these kids had never seen a chicken, of course, and they were just fascinated. And it's perfectly appropriate, though, because the Gospels, the Christian scriptures, liken God's love to the care that a mother hen shows towards her little chicks, that kind of mm-hmm. unconditional mm-hmm. Protection, running around, keeping an eye on things. Yeah.
Well, we had a chicken one time called Penny Penny, who would greet me just every time I'd come home from work. She'd greet me like a dog would greet me.
Yes.
She followed me all over the place. She came into the house. She was really my pet.
No, she was. Well,
yeah.
Ours weren't quite pets. You know, they have a rule in Vermont where we live that to purchase poultry, you have to buy at least six. They wanted to put the kibosh on. In the old days, you know, they sold chickens as novelties around mm-hmm. the Easter holiday. Get your child a chicken. And, of course, a chicken, unless you're prepared, a chicken's not a pet. They're flock animals. So
yes.
our chickens were mainly bonded with the other fowls out there in the chicken coop. But we did give them names. Faith, Hope, Charity, Fred, and Gobbledygook were some of our chickens. Yeah.
You don't have them anymore.
No. Well, we certainly never ate the hens. You know, they would go on laying well into old age, occasionally producing an egg. And my wife joked mm-hmm. that we had a geriatric nursing home for aging hens, which was certainly true. But we liked their company. But you know, I gave up eating the eggs and dairy about 3 years ago. So I'm a more of a pure vegan now.
Yes, yes. How about predators for those chickens? Did you have problems with that?
Oh, yeah, we lost one to an opossum, and there were always hawks flying around, you know, very, very interested in these things. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I was going to ask you, it sounds like you've always loved animals. Is this... What really inspired
well,
you?
Well, not so much.
Books?
You know, I may have mentioned this the last time we talked, but I was actually in my early 30s. I'd been to divinity school and was serving my first church when I had this kind of spiritual turning. It was in the mid 80s when I heard the story about Coco and her kitten, and Coco knew sign language, and the kitten was killed, and somebody asked Coco what she understood about what had happened. And
mm-hmm.
they asked her, what happens to, why do gorillas die? And Coco made the signs to answer trouble and old. And they asked Coco, you know, where do gorillas go when they die? And she made the signs comfortable, whole, like a hole in the ground. And then touching her lips to blow a kiss of farewell. And then the question was asked, how do gorillas feel when they die? Are they happy, sad? Are they afraid? And Coco made the sign of sleep. And mm-hmm. I just lost my grandfather a couple of months before that, and was really, you know, going through some grief mm-hmm. and a little bit of a crisis of faith because, you know, I'd been ordained and spent 3 years studying theology, but they don't teach you the answers to life's fundamental questions in divinity school, you know, where... You find hope, meaning, strength in the
mm-hmm,
face of
mm-hmm.
loss. You kind of have to live through that and figure it out for yourself. So there was something in Coco's story that really touched me profoundly at that time. It was like I realized that this little private load of pain and anxiety I was carrying around wasn't really private at all, you know, that my
mm-hmm.
story, my drama was enfolded in this much larger saga of birth and death and creation that was happening all around me every moment, and that had been going on for millions of years before I was born and would continue for you know, eons afterwards. So I really came to a new appreciation of my place, I guess, in the spiritual ecology of things. I I came to see life as not just the life that connected immediately to
mm-hmm.
me, my ego, my biological family, but realized I was part of this much greater web of creation. So it was a turning point for me. And that was really the genesis of my first book, The Souls of Animals, which asked the
mm-hmm.
question, are other species, you know, are they aware of death like we are, or do they share in these traits that we think of usually as being distinctively human? Do they have a moral sense or an ethical compass? Do they appreciate art or music, have an aesthetic impulse? What do animals dream about? What goes on in their unconscious life? Why do they play? And, you
mm-hmm.
know, of course
mm-hmm.
the conclusion I came to, which even then was well supported by scientific research, you know, by pioneers like Conrad Lorenz and Jane Goodall, was that
mm-hmm.
other species are much more similar to ourselves than we give them credit for.
They're much more similar than dissimilar, that's for sure. And the
oh,
fact,
yeah.
you know, the interesting that you would mention, you know, that experience put you in touch with connecting, not only the, you know, a lot of times people realize they're not alone because there's so many other people who have gone through the same thing and then they can
yeah.
share these things. But what you're talking about is this animal who is considered pretty much of a beast, you know. And
yes.
And,
well,
yeah.
animals become the projection of our own shadow selves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All our disowned characteristics are projected onto the animals, so that
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bestial becomes kind of a term of opprobrium. If you look at religious history, you know, the devil, the infernal forces, gee, it's pictured as this guy with horns and hooves and a tail and hairy haunches and very animalistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, you know, most people can easily have a sense of affinity and kinship with dogs, cats, domestic companions. But, you know, Darwin was the original biologist who
yeah.
wrote about this. He wrote a whole volume on the origin of emotions in animals and man and said whatever difference exists is a difference of degree, not of kind. And in my book, Blessings of the Animals, I have a whole chapter about worm charming, which is a topic that Darwin really explored in some depth, believe it or not.
Yeah,
He wrote a lengthy book on earthworms. In fact, his book on earthworms initially sold better than The Origin of Species. But he credited them with a great deal of intelligence from his investigations. He found that worms are deaf, and they're blind, but they're very tactily sensitive, and they're very sensitive to vibration, which he demonstrated in his own peculiar way by taking jars full of worms and putting them on the sounding board of his piano at home, and then he would play them notes of different pitches, and you know the worms didn't seem to give a hoot about the melody. But when he'd bang on the piano loud and send a vibration through them, that would send the worms scurrying, which is which was a practice that he knew about already, and that's still common in some parts of the world. In England, there's what's called a worm charming competition every year, about 200 miles from where Darwin lived, actually, where several hundred contestants will gather, and what they do is they make vibrations in the soil. Usually they stick a garden fork in the ground, or sometimes just a stake. I tried this at home to make sure it worked, so I took a tomato stake and I drove it about 8 or 10 inches into the ground, and then took an old saw with kind of a rusty blade, and you begin to play the tomato steak the way a violinist would bow a fiddle. You know, you drag that saw across it, and if you start doing it right, you begin to get this kind of imagine what a mole might sound like burrowing through the ground. Well, you have to take a leap and say, I think it's down here somewhere, a little lower. Well, if you get it right, the worm hears that or feels it, feels the vibration, and comes to the surface. They do this down in the southeastern United States, and they call it worm grunting. Worm grunting. But,
did you actually see these worms coming up?
Yeah. My wife can attest. I charmed two worms. I mean, I'm far from a world champion. In England, where they have the contest, they give you like nine square feet, and you know, the contest winner charmed like 600 worms to the surface. But Darwin writes all about them, because worms are in the habit of plugging their burrows. They dig a tunnel, and then they drag a little piece of litter or a dirt clod or a rock or a twig, often a leaf, to stop the top, maybe to keep the cold or the rain out. But Darwin experimented and took different types of leaves, different shapes. He even cut little pieces of paper into different shapes, and he found that the worms invariably would pick the paper or the leaf by the pointed end to drag it down the burrow, just as we might. You know, if you can imagine trying to haul a large piece down a small narrow circular passageway, you'd want to drag it in by the tip. So he said, well, you know, if a person were doing that, we'd credit them with problem solving. And worms don't even technically have a brain. They have a couple of ganglia, I guess. But he thought they were fairly brainy for such humble creatures. And, he continued to be a fisherman throughout his life. But out of respect and compassion for the worms, he would anesthetize them before putting them on the hook and dangling them in the water. Didn't want them to suffer more than necessary. Interesting guy. He wasn't a worm charmer, but he was charmed by worms.
Charmed by worms.
Yes.
Have you ever raised them? I mean, we used to raise worms for quite a few years.
Well, yeah, that was what sparked my interest. Yeah. My daughter lives in a student collective, and they've got worms going. They live kind of in a Rubbermaid tub in the shower there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love them too. And of course, you can't charm worms if you have used pesticides or herbicides anywhere in that area, because they don't thrive in that area, in that environment.
No, I wouldn't think so.
I was going to say too that animals love to be sung to, and if you have a sick animal, like we had Ulysses, but had cancer for maybe a year, you know, before he died, I think his life was prolonged by many, many different natural remedies that we did for him, and one of the things we did was sing to him, and he was very, very responsive. Also, we just got a wild cat that just showed up, and the cat was so wild, but tamed down immediately when I just sang to him. It took a minute, and the cat was tamed. He never was wild again.
Right, and in the souls of animals, I cite some experiment that the Dairy Farmers Association did of piping music into the dairy barns, and the cows would actually produce more milk if they were listening to classical music. They didn't like heavy metal rock so much, but you know, they were very highbrow cows.
Well, that makes sense to me. The classical music experiments with that kind of music has also accelerated children's learning, and just, you don't even have to be a child to use that kind of music. To a slow classical music does something to retain the information that you're trying to learn. And then, of course, there's the healing qualities of animals. And the one story you told was stood out very intense. I had never heard of a child or anybody else coming out of a coma.
Oh, yeah. Most states and communities have therapy dogs now. A few years ago, we had the therapy dogs of Vermont come to our church to do a little workshop and demonstration with Steve Ryman, who's their trainer, and he has German shepherds that he takes into pediatric wards around the state. He told a story about our local medical center, which is kind of a regional facility. A teenage girl had been flown in from New York, helicoptered in when an aneurysm had burst inside her brain. And she'd been there for about 5 days in a coma, completely unconscious. Nothing that the doctors were able to do seemed to be able to rouse her. And Steve happened to come into the room with his dogs. He said that her mom was there, and she excused herself, like to go down and grab a cup of coffee or something. And while she was out of the room, the dogs, one of the dogs just crawled up into bed with this young woman and sort of sprawled across her chest, you know, just gave her the big dog hug and maybe applied a little miracle dog slobber there to her face, you know. But Steve said it was just amazing that this girl was lying, you know, prone on her back, and her arms were just lifeless at her side, and all of a sudden these arms that had been motionless for days just started to levitate, to come up in the air, and just went a circle around this dog. You know, the warmth, the fur, the pulsing life there. It just transferred right into her and brought her back to life. So it was puppy love that did what modern medicine couldn't do. But yeah.
Well, I think there's probably a lot of stories like that. It would be interesting to see how many there are. I also heard of people coming out of comas when they hear Christmas carols, which goes to show that there's such a deep emotional thing that happens. You know, you start hearing them when you're a baby, basically.
Well, Christmas carols are any kind of songs, nursery rhyme, poetry. Now, there's a lot of research that suggests that poetry is our mother tongue. It's kind of recorded in a different part of the brain than our more prosaic speech patterns. And there's actually a technique that they use with stroke victims, which who've lost the ability to speak. You know, their intelligence is there, but they just cannot find the word. They can't produce the sound that goes with the thought. It's impossible for them. And it's called melodic intonation therapy. And what they do is take the right hand that connects to the left hemisphere and tap out a beat with the right hand while, you know, reciting familiar poems and songs. And somehow that seems to get into the parts of the brain to begin to unlock the language ability. So, yeah.
Yeah, can those people who can't speak, can they write what they're thinking or not?
Oh, well, sometimes, but often not. Sometimes.
Yeah, it depends on the if base what part of the brain is affected.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to be sure to tell one story that really struck me, that I was personally involved in. You know, blessing of the animals, as I said, they're usually happy occasions and everybody has a bark and good time. But one of the blessings that I did had a much more somber and solemn character. And this was in the mid-90s. I got a call from a local artist. Well, she's local, but she really has an international reputation. I'd never heard of her at the time, though, and she called me because she had an art show that she was about to hang for a special one-week exhibition. She had managed to take over a vacant space downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted me to come in as a clergyman and to bless this space.
Mm-hmm.
Because what she had done was to paint the portraits of 23 primates who had died in a Philadelphia zoo fire. I think this was 95, Christmas Day. This facility that housed orangutans, gibbons, lemurs, gorillas,
mm-hmm.
they all died in this fire. You know, just very.
I remember that. Remember that incident. Yeah.
Well, you probably do. You know, I don't think you could hear that story of such a waste of so much beautiful life and not be affected in some way.
Yes.
But Sally, as an artist, was more affected than most, and she decided that she was drawn to this for reasons she couldn't entirely explain, and felt a need to paint these animals who had perished. So she got in touch with, you know, the curator at the zoo and was able to get multiple photographs of them and began
mm-hmm.
to get acquainted with them as individual personalities and to render these incredibly powerful portraits of these animals. You know, she paints very large and extremely vivid work. So she was hanging these portraits in this what used to be like a retail clothing outlet, but now had become a place of memorial to the spirits of these departed animals, and she wanted me to bless it, which I did. But you know, the show was for a week. My blessing was probably over in a few minutes, and Sally had to decide what these portraits were for. Were they to keep, to use for some larger purpose? And she went to asking guidance to a drumming circle. She called it a grandmother's circle, where they sat drumming for about 10 hours. And it came to her that what the primates wanted was to be remembered, which she understood in the sense of being remembered or returned or reintegrated into the homelands, the natural environments where these species had originally lived and evolved. So she decided that what the portraits needed to do was to go back home and be buried.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, when they heard this idea, thought it was kind of offbeat. You know, she was asked, well, these are beautiful works of art. Why don't you auction them off or sell them to charity? You know, you could give the proceeds to wildlife conservation or the Jane Goodall Institute or something. And Sally, though, was really clear about this. You know, these animals had been captive their whole lives. They'd lived behind glass and bars. They'd been there for human, you know, education or amusement. And she thought that, you know, in death, she wasn't going to make money off them. They needed to be liberated and set free. So
mm-hmm.
she had to find a way to get these portraits back to their place of origin. And she was able to contact somebody with World Wildlife, who just happened to work in Borneo, which was the homeland of the orangutans and gibbons, and Madagascar,
mm-hmm.
where the lemurs lived, and Cameroon, which was the home of the gorillas. And Sally was able to work with them and contact the indigenous people in these territories, which were fairly remote. The Dayak and in Borneo, the Atindroy in Madagascar, the Bakwiri people in Cameroon. She wanted them to somehow support this vision. So she was able to meet with the tribal leaders and you know, with her own drawings and translators, explain what her purpose was to bury these portraits, and they understood this entirely. So that's what happened to these magnificent portraits that
mm-hmm,
she did.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. She said the Antandroi in Madagascar were actually such primitive people, or so remote from, you know, Western technology and civilization, that they had actually never seen two-dimensional artwork before. They made sculptures, but the first time that they saw these large portraits of the lemurs, which are very lifelike, they couldn't believe it. They didn't know what was happening. They kept like lifting the pages to see how, what was under them, you know, how could the three-dimensional figure be flattened like that. And then when they finally started to catch on, they like rubbed their hands all over the images and then rubbed their own bodies with their hands to like transfer the magic. And you know, the Antandroi, these people also, they don't bury their dead. That's not their custom. Rather, they suspend them from cliffs, from the heights. So the gorillas were buried, the orangutans were buried, the lemurs were suspended from the cliffs, given over to the wind and the elements. And as Sally said, you know, remembered in the way that a leaf is remembered into the forest floor when it falls. Really, really, I don't know.
It's profound.
It is. What a vision. You know, she's not an artist. She's a real visionary, I think.
Like a mystic.
Well, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had talked about the flight of the snow geese. That's another amazing thing, that they actually travel one half of the distance to the moon. And do they do that in their lifetime, or do they do that every season?
Well, that would be over the course of a 20-year lifespan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, the geese can cover thousands of miles in their annual migrations, and some species will, you know, fly at heights of 5 miles over the Himalayas. So they're real athletes, and geese have become proverbial for society. You know, you've probably heard the parables about high-flying geese. You know, they fly in the V, they take turns with the leadership because it breaks the wall of air, and they can fly distances 70% farther that way. Part of the story, which I think is legendary, because I haven't been able to confirm this, quite the contrary, but, you know, the story is that if a goose is shot by hunters, two others from the V will follow it to the ground and try to come to assistance. Well,
right.
I've talked with hunters and read about goose hunting, and that just doesn't happen. But actually, these big birds do have an incredible capacity for courage and compassion, regardless. There's one story which is true about a goose that found itself in the predicament of being frozen to the ice in Maryland on the Tredavon River when there was a sudden cold snap overnight. Its feet were, you know, stuck on the surface of the river, and it couldn't free itself. The woman who reported this was watching it through binoculars, wondering what she should do to help, when she spotted a line of swans coming in over the horizon. Now, if you know anything about geese and swans, they're not natural friends. Swans can be quite aggressive towards geese. So she was worried. You know, she thought these swans might attack this frozen bird.
Mm-hmm.
And they landed, and instead of attacking, they began to chip and chisel at the ice with their beaks until the goose's webbed feet were free of the ice. And then they flew up into the air to see what happened. But overnight, the bird's wings were still, you know, frozen. Couldn't really spread its wings. So they came
mm-hmm.
down again, the swans, and began chipping and chiseling at the wings with their beaks until finally the goose was able to get airborne and followed these swans off as they rejoined their flock, migrating farther south. So, yeah, they're amazing birds, good role models for us, models of cooperation and teamwork and caring
wow.
leadership.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we live on a river here in Lancaster County, Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, damn,
and,
yeah.
We've lived here about 22 years, but when Ulysses was alive, he would go down to the river. At least these geese would come by every springtime and commune with Huley. I could tell they were the same geese, and I could tell that they were doing this, that he was developing a relationship with them. And it was just one of the most beautiful, very calming. It wasn't like anything spectacular. It was just, you could just tell that there was a lot of camaraderie going on between, like this interspecies communication that keeps coming up in your book.
Yes. Well, there is interspecies communication, you know, between people and geese. Conrad Lorenz, of course, was famous for this. He was the ethologist who kind of discovered imprinting in baby birds. When he was a
mm-hmm.
child growing up in Austria, his first pet was, you know, a baby duck, and he remembers going out to the Danube and with his playmates, and the baby ducks would follow them around. So even as children, they had that bond of being family. But you know, there's kind of a funny story that I tell about the book Make Way for Ducklings.
Uh-huh.
And, probably everybody knows this book. Robert McCloskey, he illustrated it himself, and is full of these kind of happy-go-lucky ducks on their way to Boston. But apparently he spent about 2 years trying to draw a duck to get the look just right, you know, and he'd try
mm-hmm.
and draw them in the sky and in the wild and on the lakes, and he couldn't get close enough, and he'd go to museums, but there they were, like, in dioramas and stuffed and things. And he was living in Greenwich Village with a roommate, both of them young artists at that time, and finally ended up taking ducks into his apartment and putting them in the bathtub, but they would they would still move around too fast for him to get his sketchbook out. So they ended up sharing the table wine with the ducks, and that was how he got them mellow enough to create these wonderful characters for the storybook. Yeah. But lots of ways we bond with animals, and you know that's what we celebrate in the
blessing
ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have many stories about owls?
I don't have many stories about owls. Just a short one from England, where a dog and an owl bonded and became best friends, and you know the owl would go riding around the house on the dog's back and so forth. But it sounds like maybe you have some stories.
I just have to tell you this story because you will. It's unbelievable. We my husband is Tom, and his aunt Hilda was dying basically. So And she was an animal lover that you wouldn't, she was just a real animal lover. And on our way over there, Tom said to me, and she lives in Gettysburg, so he, we were going across the Gettysburg battlefield. And he said, I really wish we could do more, and I wish we would live closer. And at that moment, he hit something, and something in his head said, stop, it's an owl.
Hmm.
We stopped, and we picked up this owl that he had hit, and it was a sowlet owl. And they're small little owls, and their migratory pattern goes over the Gettysburg battlefield long before it was ever a battlefield.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got that owl, and we brought it home, and we nursed it back to health. And the owl was very charismatic. The owl lived in the barn, and we would purchase mice for this owl.
Yes.
And put one mouse into the pocket, walk into the barn, and the sowlet owl would come out of nowhere, and like lightning, so fast, would get this mouse right out of the pocket and go straight up to the beam of the barn and look down before he ate, before she ate this little mouse, she'd thank us. And almost like she would bow, thank you. She did this every time we brought in a mouse. And she was very entertaining. You know, we would take people in and show them how she did this. And she loved to perform. She was very, like I said, very charismatic. She loved people. But the day that Hilda died, this owl buried herself head first into the corner of the barn, and she died the very moment that Hilda died.
Really?
So, yeah. So anyway, we did consult a psychic because it was very interesting and unusual, and there was a correlation. I mean, I don't believe in coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman, the psychic, said that Hilda, loving animals the way she did, and she was in a coma for 6 months, and her son had a very difficult time releasing her from life support. So that was why she was, you know, sort of in a coma for that long.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychic said that Hilda and Tom were very close, that Hilda was communicating with Tom through this owl and was keeping that communication alive while she was in a coma and while we were far away and really couldn't get there that much. And, I mean, we were not terribly far away, but we both had full-time jobs, etc. And this owl was her way, and it must be deeper than that. You know, it's much larger than that somehow. But it was remarkable.
You know, I've led many bereavement support groups over my years of being a minister, and in these groups, which consist of people who've, you know, suffered recent losses, you do hear odd, inexplicable stories. And I try to keep an open mind. You know, I don't really know what the explanation is, but you hear the stories too often to discount them. One of my chapters in my Blessings of the Animals book is animals as guides for the departed. You know, the dog Star, Sirius, plays this role.
Yeah.
In a lot of cultures, it's associated with both canines and being a beacon to souls to the next world. And it's weird. It's like plays this role for the Chinese, the Greeks, the Egyptians, Native American people. You know, the Inuit call Sirius the moon dog. For the bunny, it's the coyote Star. Just these widely separated civilizations all make this connection. And there's this great story from India, from the Mahabharata, which is one of their oldest scriptures, about 2,500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In the Mahabharata, it's about a guy who's on a spiritual quest, Yudhishthira. And it comes to the very end of this very, very long book. It's like, you know, 10 times as long as the Yellow Pages or something. But he comes to the end and he's reached his goal. He's at the summit of the Himalayas. He's climbed the highest peak, and all his brothers and traveling companions have fallen away, weighted down by their accumulated karma and so forth. But the hero, Yudhishthira, is upright and blameless and pure of heart. And so he reaches the gates of heaven there at the top of the mountain, and Indra, the king of the gods, is waiting there to welcome him. And he says, "Well done, Yudhishthira. You know, you've made it. You've achieved it. You're worthy of entry into the gates of bliss. But mm-hmm. I have to tell you, I see that you've been accompanied by a dog all this way, and we don't allow dogs in heaven. They're not worthy of eternity." And Yudhishthira says, "What? I never heard of this before. This dog's been with me the whole way. He's been faithful and loyal, and I couldn't possibly abandon him now." And Indra says, "Well, a rule's a rule. you have to leave the dog outside." So Yudhishthira hesitates for a minute, and he says, "Well, if the dog can't go in, I'm not going to go to heaven either. I'm going to forego my chance at immortality rather than abandon this creature that's been so close to me and such a comfort all this way." And at this mm-hmm. point in the story, at the very conclusion of this, you know, this Mahabharata, this was the final test. This was just the final trial. The dog is actually a god, and the dog's name is Savana, which means dog, and the dog becomes the dog star up in the sky, you know, in the timeless celestial realm of heaven. And mm-hmm. so both man and mutt enter into the realm of bliss and enlightenment, which is a beautiful story, you know. You'd like to think that if there is a heaven, pets can go there. And I guess at a less than literal level, to me it says that, you know, where is it that we find a little foretaste of heaven, of bliss on earth? Well, it's in these relationships of unconditional love and loyalty, like the ones we share with our pets.
When you're with your pet, you feel like you're in heaven. So you don't really have to go. You don't have to go anywhere. We have a place nearby, about an hour and a half away, actually, called the Grotto of Lourdes, and it's this beautiful, beautiful place that apparently, you know, kind of mimics the Lourdes, France, where people mm-hmm. go and mm-hmm. pilgrims come from all over the country, and they go there to be healed. And there's huge statues of Mother Mary. You can see this golden statue of Mother Mary at least 30 miles away. And it kind of draws you to it. And the director of the grotto, his name is William Trenalone, and he's a friend of ours. And he became very attracted to Ulysses. We would take Ulysses. That was another thing we did, is take Ulysses there for healing. Mm-hmm. And Bill said that he had a dog just like him, that he was just loved that dog, and the dog died suddenly. And he and one of the priests, or even a person higher up in the Catholic Church, did tell Bill that dogs don't go to heaven. And Bill stood up and got very straight, and he argued with this authority on the subject. And he was telling us about this, and he was very, very passionate about the fact that dogs do go to heaven. He knows it. And it's really great that he stood up to that authority, because, you know, he's a devout Catholic.
Well, of course, church teaching has varied over the centuries, but if you look to the very earliest images from Christian tradition, like in the catacombs, you find these mm-hmm. incredible frescoes of Jesus surrounded by animals, you know, with a dove on his shoulder, carrying a lamb. There are dolphins, dogs, birds, wild uh-huh. creatures, tame creatures, places like the tomb of Cyriacus, who was a Christian bishop who died in around the year 300. So we're talking very early. You know, these are obviously images of paradise. The way it was in the beginning and will be once again when we're in right relation with the rest of creation. And it, you know, for the early Christians, Jesus was clearly the Lord and Savior of the animals.
Well, the blessings of the animals, in terms of the services that you do, wasn't that originally inspired Well, I know it goes way back, but wasn't that originally inspired by St. Francis?
Well, not originally. No, I think the Rogation days. There's an even older Saint Anthony the Abbot, who's from the 4th century, and his feast day is still celebrated in Rome, and people will bring their pets and other creatures to be sprinkled. But Francis mm-hmm. is part of this very old tradition, and there are dozens of saints in the traditions of Celtic Christianity
mm-hmm.
who are well known for their special rapport with animals.
Do you have any sheep stories? I have one I think you'd love.
I don't have a sheep story.
See, sheep are considered to be dumb animals. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth. We had a herd of sheep maybe 15 years ago. And these sheep, one was Hansel, who was the ram, of course, and then he had Nettle, whom he loved, and we had another one named Daisy. But Nettle died, and he suffered from that death. And what happened was Tom was burying Nettle. And as he was burying her, there were a lot of roots in the way. And he felt that he couldn't get through these roots. He couldn't get the shovel to sever the roots to bury the sheep. And he said, oh, my gosh, please help me. You know, he was kind of praying about getting some help to bury the sheep. And suddenly Hansel jumped into the hole, and he nibbled each root one by one until they were severed. And then he got out, and he looked at him and said, there you go, buddy, or something. And Tom was able to bury the sheep, and it was like unbelievable ESP connection there.
Hmm. Yes, that is amazing. No, I know sheep aren't dumb at all. You know, studies have been done, and a sheep can recognize the face of dozens and dozens of its individual herd mates. So to us, they kind of all blend together. But if you're a sheep, they're distinctive personalities. Although I do mention, you know, that all the animal legends surrounding Christmas, since we're in the Christmas season here, there were the shepherds watching their fields by night. Well, I've been told that probably the shepherds had some goats as well, because most competent shepherds will have a goat in the flock.
Mm-hmm.
The goats maybe tend to be a little more savvy and strategic when there's a coyote or a predator trying to separate an individual from the herd. So,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes.
I just think they're all, the interspecies communication is one of the most beautiful things in the world. And, you know, just studying my dog and our cat right now, they were terrified of each other at first. Well, Pearl seemed like she wanted to kill the cat, but now they love each other. They just frolic around and play hide and seek for hours. And I don't know, the transformation happened just instantaneously. And the singing had something to do with this. But anyway, oh my gosh, it's wonderful. So we've actually come to the end of this hour. Can you believe that?
Well, it's been fun, Kate, hasn't it? I told you, animal blessings—they're fun to do and fun to talk about. So I had a blast writing this book, and thanks for letting me talk about it.
Yeah, and I'll get this link to you, and we'll just sprinkle it all over the world. How's that sound?
Great. Okay.
Have a great season of holiday spirit, and love your animals. Pieces.
All right. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Here is the music of Mother and Child by Crosby Jensen.